It's time for Brother Larry's Sinner's Sunday. Oh yeah. You tell him, Larry. Brother Larry coming at ya.
Thank you, Brother Dre. And thank you, Lariettes. And welcome to Sinner's Sunday, the world's longest Saturday after party, where the beer is cold, the ribs are hot, and all the women are pointy. And here we are, already in our ninth gathering, and it occurs to me, we may have some new revelers with us today. I see so many hats pulled low over faces and sunglasses in the crowd. Perhaps some newcomers are here. So why is everybody here? Well, regular listeners know this is a very different Sunday hang. If you were overserved last night, here you can get a hair of the dog. We've no dress code. We don't care what you wear or say, and if you want to recline fully in one of those barca loungers, each being equipped with a cup holder big enough to hold a tall boy, go right ahead, pull that lever, and relax. Last Sunday was Easter Sunday, and as I am compelled to do every Easter and Christmas, La Familia and I all piled in the fun wagon and headed down to the local church, which was packed with other creasters. And usually there's some mildly snarky comment from the pulpit about those very sporadic attendees. They're also referred to as CEOs, Christmas and Easter only. One year a guy told us we were a bunch of submarines. We only surface at Christmas and Easter. And all the people chortle and titter. That's kind of like some restaurant owner berating customers who don't visit there as often as he'd like. Of course, they never ever ask themselves why attendance is sporadic. Because that's part and parcel of organizations everywhere. Organizations never self-doubt. They never question themselves, and they are arrogant as fuck. Now, the Roman Catholic Church is no exception to that rule, nor is any big-time religion I know of, or corporation, or government agency, whatever the outfit, regardless of location, mission, or membership, they are invariably infallible, right? And woe unto he who questions or challenges their authority. Steve Jobs was an amateur. Organized religions are the world's greatest marketers. They sell a product you cannot see or touch or smell or taste until you're dead. And then only if you behave in a certain way and follow their rules and give generously. Actually, Christians do offer a taste and touch experience with communion. And many believe it is actually transformed into the body and blood of Christ. It's tough to get your mind around that one. Still seems like a sliver of flavorless bread and cheap wine to me. I think that at the Last Supper, J.C. knew his time was very short, and he tried to impress upon his crew how much he wanted them to remember him and all he taught them once he was gone. And according to Matthew's gospel, he did say the wine was his blood, but is that detail really all that important? People get so hung up on these things, they seem to miss the big message. It's not hard to imagine how that scene must have played out. Everybody eating together. Wine and jokes and chit-chat as might happen anywhere that friends gather to break bread. And then maybe he gets silent, and so do they. It's late afternoon, almost dusk, and the wind kicks up across the desert. The sunlight is golden and warm, but still, there's this uneasy, sad feeling that just settles over the room. And maybe he raises a cup and tells them, this adventure with all of you will soon end. We've done so much together and seen so much, and you must remember everything. So when each day is done, and you take your supper and you pour the wine and break the bread, think of me because I will always be with you, even when I'm gone. When I was a kid, lots of my friends were altar boys. I never was. The idea didn't appeal to me. The outfits looked a little too much like dresses, and they did way too much kneeling, and any job that ends in the word boy lacks dignity. Cabin boy, ball boy, towel boy, cabana boy, pool boy, lawn boy, water boy, best boy, rent boy. But one of my pals, Dennis, was kind of a wild man and an altar boy, and one day after doing a 7 o'clock mass, yes, that was 7 a.m., he comes to class and he's just a bag of giggles, and I want in on the joke, but he can't stop laughing, and I want a piece of that hilarity, and the more I ask him what's so funny, the more he laughs but won't answer me. A couple days later, he invites me to the sacristy. That is, kind of the green room in the church behind the altar where cast members will put on shin guards and helmets and jerseys and get ready for some contact holiness. And I'm wondering, what the hell could be so funny back here? Did he have a joke book stashed or some goofy toy? And Dennis says,
"Hey man, here's what's funny."
And he reaches into a cabinet and pulls out a gallon jug of Manischewitz red wine. And I'm like, okay, so they used Jewish wine in a Catholic church. Mildly amusing, but not bust-a-gut funny. And Dennis unscrews the cap and sticks his finger through the jug handle and hoists it on his elbow, hillbilly style, and takes a heroic slug. I mean, he must have chugged an inch off the volume easy. And then he says,
"Have a few slugs of this and everything is funny, man."
He hands me the jug, and I hillbilly up and down a few swallows. It was so weak, it barely tasted any different from the Welsh's grape juice back in the fridge at home. But being only, I don't know, 8, 9, maybe 10 years old, and well under 100 pounds, and a non-drinker, other than the occasional gulps from my old man's beer, which Dad supervised, that Manischewitz hit me like 2 doubles of Wild Turkey 101. And we go back to class with a hell of a buzz. And Dennis was right. Long division was funny. So was science and geography. Well, the Tropic of Cancer was a fucking laugh riot. By the time religion was being taught, the crucifixion was like the clown car at the circus, and Brother Cyril threw both our asses out of class. I'll bet he was considering recommending us for an exorcism. What we really needed was detoxing. But I digress. Where was I? Oh yeah, infallibility. One of the shittiest words in the language. Yet, every organization, from bumfuck City Hall to Washington, D.C., is never ever wrong. And when it's a God-providing franchise, it gets even crazier. Because then they imbue some dude with infallibility, and now you've got a can't-miss recipe for disaster. Plenty of faiths appoint these demigods, from small-timers like Father Divine, who we looked at in episode 73, to big-time like pharaohs and Chinese and Japanese emperors and Dalai Lamas and commie deities like Stalin and Mao, and of course, popes. But it does seem of late the PR boys from Vatican City tend to downplay the infallibility angle, don't they? Because one only need crack the history books a wee bit to uncover a rich and sleazy legacy of
devil popes.
One of the best who may have inspired La Cosa Nostra was Leo X. He ran a kick-ass protection racket, selling get-out-of-hell passes to rich guys. He had a rate card with so many lira for every sin you could imagine, from theft to murder. Just pony up, and with a wave of his crozier, you were absolved of sin and free to sin again. Wonder if those guys complained to the Better Business Bureau when they found themselves engulfed in flame with Lucifer shoving hot pitchforks up their asses.
"But Leo said I was covered."
"Yeah, fuck Leo. He's in the next room." Just a few years before Leo was Julius II. Julie had a swarm of girlfriends, and he wasn't too choosy about them either, because when they finally indicted him for his prurient misdeeds, they called him a shameful sodomite covered with ulcers. Ugh. He also had at least one kid, maybe more. Pope Alexander VI, he knew how to live it up. He regularly held masquerades, dance parties, and had beaucoup girlfriends. There are no images of them, but their names alone sound pointy as hell. Giulia Farnese and Vanozza de Catani. I hear those names and I see slinky wrists, ankle straps, and eternal damnation, and I want it. Alexander also had several kids with each of those bimbonis. And I suspect it's no different in any big-time religion anywhere in the world. Some think tank should do a study on organizations of all types, not just religions, and figure out what the number is at which point they become utterly corrupt and unfixable. The U.S. government has been at that place for a long time. Massive numbers of overpaid, corrupt parasites with Cadillac benefits and lifetime pensions and mammoth expense accounts and chauffeured cars and limitless power. So colossally fucked, it cannot get unfucked. It simply needs to be deleted and rebooted. And big religions are the same way. But back to fifth grade. After tanking up with Dennis in the sacristy a few times, I was giving this altar boy thing a second thought. And that's when we let another pal, Rocky, in on the party. Rocky was a recent transfer from Flatbush in Brooklyn, which at that time then made our less-than-upscale part of Queens look like Beverly Hills. And Dennis and I tell Rocky about the Manischewitz, and Rocky cocks an eyebrow and says, "What are you drinking that piss for? Let's go to my place for lunch." So we hike over the railroad bridge, and there, on Corona Avenue, was a joint that looked like a Tony Soprano hang, the Little Villa. Brick facade with a front window and cozy curtains in it, and those basket Chianti bottles in the window with that little plaster pizza chef statue wearing the big toque and a pencil-lined mustache with a smile and a wink. Yeah, that same little pizza chef that's been on every pizza box since Christ was a corporal, and the chef's cartoon talk box says the same thing whether you're in Queens or Queensland. "You've tried the rest, now try the best." And we follow Rocky inside. And this white-haired old man with an apron smiles. And we sit at a table. For fans of Breaking Bad, the old guy looked exactly, and I mean exactly, like Tuco's uncle, Hector Salamanca. And the place has red carpeting and a big Rockola jukebox filled with nothing but Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Vic Damone and Louis Prima. We're in a Goomba time warp. We settle into a table, and Rocky, he acts like he owns the joint, and he tells me and Dennis, "The pizza is really good, but the beer is fucking great." Dennis and I are just slack-jawed with, like, "How would you know?" And Rocky leans across the table conspiratorially and beckons us to listen close and says, "The old man's just off the boat from Sicily where they ain't got no drinking laws. His son owns the joint, but don't come in till dinner. So let's fucking drink." The old man brings us menus and indicates we should point to what we want. And we point to a large pizza, and Rocky points to the Miller High Life and holds up three fingers. And the old man nods and smiles and walks away and comes back in about a minute with three frosty Pilsner glasses with perfect heads, and holy shit, we're drinking beer in a restaurant on a school day at lunch. We nurse him for about 10 minutes. And the old guy brings us a pizza, and Rocky orders refills, and the old man smiles again and heads for the kitchen. And the front door opens, and in walks a cop in uniform. Just when the old man comes back to our table with a little tray holding three icy cold beers. Oh, shit. If you want to hear the rest of the story, come back Tuesday and it'll be waiting for you. Lots of bonus episodes, signed books, custom recordings, and more waiting for you at patreon.com/thatlarryshow. Write to me at thatlarryshow@gmail.com or drop us a voicemail at 302-71-LARRY. We'll see you Tuesday. And until that time, God bless and bon appetit.